And Ron Wotus, the professor, is here with me. Woe, how are you today?
I'm doing great. And it's great to know the strawberries are coming in as well, because it's that time of year they're starting to get really, really good.
I'm telling you, and he actually offered me one. And, you know, they had 10,000 strawberries, and I tried one, and it was terrific. Very good. So I came in with the strawberries yesterday. It was the chicken and the tater tots and the hot dog rolls. Today was the strawberries.
Oh, nothing like a good meal, Marty. Nothing like a good meal. And happy Mother's Day to everybody out there as well.
All right. Well, let's start off with Mother's Day for you. And you know, you and I have done the show now for a number of years, and we've been on together for some Mother's Day when you guys are home. But a very special time in everyone's lives to take a deep breath and think back. And you're an athlete and playing so many games and coming home. And what did Mom mean to you in your career?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, very similar. I was listening to John Miller talk about Cal Ripken as Mom and what she did for him. And I think it's the same for a lot of kids out there that are in youth sports. The mom is the one taking them there, making sure they're there on time, you know, taking care of them, cooking for them and all that. And it was the same thing with for me. My dad was at work. My mom was the one that took us to the sporting events. She was always there for us. The meals, made sure your uniform was clean, all those things that go along for the moms. And, you know, she was great. And, you know, the thing that really stands out for me is even now, you know, you think when you're younger, but now, you know, you call Mom now. And that's the great thing about moms. They're always there for you. They're, even though they're having a rough time or a bad day, they never let you know it, right? They don't want to upset you. So those are the things I really appreciate about my mom. She hasn't had an easy go in her life, but she's would never let you know it and is always there to support you even to this day.
Yeah, beautiful. And, you know, I talked to some of the players yesterday about some of this stuff. And we talked about meals when you would come home after playing a game or something like that. How about those meals you get?
Oh, tremendous. You know, my mom, I love a good sandwich, and nobody makes a sandwich like Mom, right? She puts the extra love into the sandwich. But, you know, my mom was Italian. My father was Polish. Wotus is Polish. My mom is Italian. Both the grandparents are from Italy and Poland. So my mom would make Polish dishes, but our go-to meal would be spaghetti. You know, she put all the meat in there. She'd put lamb in it or steak or pork and made a great pasta. Yes.
You know, it's funny you say that. You know, and growing up in my household, we didn't have the Italian influence. Trust me, we didn't have that. You could imagine. We had spaghetti with ketchup.
Oh, I never had that, Marty.
Until I went to college. I'm serious. I never understood how you could have that's the way we grew up.
Wow.
That was Jewish people from New York and all that. We didn't have the Italian influence, trust me.
Wow, yeah. No, I can't imagine having a spaghetti and making the sauce, just pouring some ketchup on top.
I liked it.
You missed out. You did. Well,
yeah,
you grew up
good.
With it, right.
Yeah. You know, you come. That was one of my comfort meals, absolutely. All right, yesterday, very good game for the Giants yesterday. All the elements were there, so you win one, you win two, and now you try to win three today.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, it's really hard to believe. And to imagine that, you know, this first time we won two in a row at this point in the season, it took this long, and it tells you just how difficult things have been for us. But, you know, the last couple of days, even the last game in New York, I think the attitude, the fight, the desire has been ratcheted up, and it's showing in the performance. And, you know, it's real easy when things aren't going well that you go the other way. You know, your confidence is down. Here we go again. But it's nice to win those two games, and the vibe has been fantastic the last couple of days.
How about the 17-inning game? And, boy, there's so many facets to it. First of all, you win the game. If you're going to play 5 hours, 28 minutes, you might as well win the game.
Right, absolutely. Well, you know, and you look at the significance of the game, it didn't have the significance of the playoff game that we had with Washington that went 18 innings. But in a lot of ways, it did. I mean, we're struggling to win games. It showed a lot of character. It showed a lot of fight. It's real easy to say, oh, here we go again, 17 innings, and to lower the energy and the effort to win that game. It's human nature. I mean, you're playing at 1 o'clock in the morning. But we did not. And to win that game, when you win those games, there is a carryover effect. And, you know, that could spiral you into a couple more losses. And not just winning that game, but coming out yesterday after that win and playing the way we did, which is, again, another tough go because you're on 5 hours sleep. And you got to come out and do it again. And that's the attitude and the fight and the determination to say, hey, I'm not tired. I want to be in there. I want to play this game, opposed to, oh, I need a day off. It was a long game yesterday. So to win these two games the way we did, I'm really encouraged to see that.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Even for me, let me tell you, I was glad it was over. I don't know how you felt, but, you know, you reach a certain point. I said, all right, I've seen enough.
There's no question. Look, that's human nature. I mean, nobody wants to play 17 innings. Everybody wants to go to work and you know, play the 9 innings, or a guy goes to work and your boss says, hey, look, you know, we got 2 hours of extra work. You know, you're going to have to cancel your dinner tonight because you have to be here. And it's, nobody wants that. And it's no different here. And it's a little different when you play 10, 11, 12 innings. But when you start getting 15, 16, 17 innings, you want to end the game. And I think every at bat, when guys go up there, they try to do too much. They want to hit a homer. They want to end the game. So they're difficult games to play in, and it's a big game to win, no doubt about it.
It makes you think at all about everything that Rob Manfred talked about at spring training. And I saw it in Cuba when I was there, you know, in extra innings. They put
right.
the two runners on base. We saw it in the WBC.
Right.
I don't know, and I know you're a traditional guy, but when you get back to the 15th, 16th inning, did it ever cross your mind to say that maybe that's not such a bad idea?
I'd be lying to you if I didn't tell you I did think about it. You know, I watched the games in the WBC. As you said, you saw him in Cuba, and you know, I felt bad for Bam Bam to be in those games in the WBC. It was the Netherlands, I think, in Japan. And, you know, it gets your wheels turning on how you would play that inning. Do you bunt? Do you not bunt? What's the pluses? What's the minuses of it? But there's no question. I think it was the 16th inning, and we started thinking about it. We were down to our last pitcher. Matt Cain went in, put his shoes on. He was going to have to pitch next. Wow. When Corey Guerin was done. And what a job the pitching staff did. Everybody rose to the occasion to put up goose eggs in multiple innings. Guys that have been throwing one inning or maybe two max, you're going three innings, and that's not easy to do. So I did think about it. I'm not ready to say let's do that in a game of baseball, but I think it might possibly happen someday. I really do. I think as the game moves forward, and it might not be the 10th inning or the 11th inning, but maybe it's the 15th inning. So we'll see.
Yeah, no, good point. And I, you know, you could talk about it, but when you see it happen and you get in one of those games and you see the reality of it, and maybe it's not that bad of an idea, but we'll see. We'll see where it goes. Posey had a big home run. He had a good week. He hit the ball. He didn't miss his pitch when they threw it up around his letters, boy. He is clubbing the ball, and, you know, I always say, you know, he's a guy who maybe in the clubhouse shows more emotion of himself to the fans when he plays. It's a buster hug for someone else. He got into it for himself, and he was upset when this first ball didn't go out. That was an interesting game for Posey, I thought.
Well, you're right in the fact that he's really been swinging the bat the way we know Buster Posey can swing the bat. I think he's figured out something in his swing this last road trip. He hit the three home runs in New York. The bat's getting in the slot. He's pulling the ball again, which, you know, you remember when he first came up, he drove the ball out to left field. He's always been an inside out hitter and used the whole field, and that's what makes him such a great hitter. But I think he's found something there in his swing that's, helping him get the ball out front and pull the ball again. And as we were saying, you're in those extra inning games. It's not worse for anybody on the field than a catcher. You're sitting back there and it's grueling. You're tired. And when he goes up there, he's determined to end the game. And he drove that one ball in the gap and got no results and certainly was upset. And I know he's thinking about driving a ball out of the ballpark in that game, and he did it to win it. And that's what makes him such a great player.
Well, you're a Yankee fan at heart, probably, you know, no Red Sox, but you're an East Coast guy. Joe DiMaggio, you know that. The one moment when he hit the ball, the left center field, and Al Gianfrido in the 47 World Series made the one-handed catch, and DiMaggio kicked the dirt. It's the only time the guy ever showed
really?
Any emotion ever. And I had that feeling with Posey, because you never see him, you know, if you read the lips and that kind
right.
of stuff, you never see it. And that was, he was upset. He
yeah.
really was.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as we talked about, you know, those are moments and games that, you know, you want to be over. Shoot,
yeah.
You're playing 17 innings, 15 innings. You want to go home. You got a day game the next day.
It was pretty cool.
Yeah,
it's
great to see.
It was pretty cool. It was a nice moment. A couple of things for the professor here in that game. One, Brian Morris really pitched well. He came in and gave you three solid innings, but he picked off the scooter. You know, the triple guy, the guy who gets triples like they're giving out Skittles, as they like to say. You know, and they picked him off second base. And tell us about the play. I always call it the timing play, but what do you call it?
Well, that particular play looked like a timing pickoff because of the way the head looks that the pitcher used and all that. But it was actually a daylight play. Him and Craw had no play on. You know, the timing pick is when you give the pitcher the sign and you're going to go off his head looks, whether it's one or two, and the pitcher turns his head home, you break to the base. But, you know, I talked to Mo about it. He said he saw the runner out there and felt he was getting a little lackadaisical, and Craw was thinking right along with him. You know, they saw his demeanor at second base, and you know, Morris was looking to pick him off, and not a lot of pitchers are looking to do that. And that's what's so great about a game like that. You know, a base hit there and you lose the game, but they're thinking outside of the box or wanting to try to get out of the inning any way you can. And I love to see that with a pitcher. And he said he was, he looked at Craw, and Craw gave him that look, and he broke to the base. Yeah, he broke to the base, and he was ready for it. And that's it. Most of the time, pitchers are so focused on the hitter, they're not ready to make the throw. And the way he made the throw, I mean, I didn't realize he had this quick of a move to second base. It was a great play by both guys.
So what's the look? Does he raise his eyebrows, you know, just to make eye contact?
Yeah, the eye contact gives it. You know, when the pitcher picks him up, you got to watch the guy to see if he's looking to go. Now, sometimes our infielders will give a little heads-up sign. You know, they could give a turning of the glove, or they could do something to let the pitcher know, stay with me, I'm going to go. Other times it just happens at the moment because a pitcher looks at him and the infielder, as soon as they make eye contact, he breaks and the pitcher sees him breaking and he'll turn and throw.
You know, a very famous play in the 1948 World Series with Bob Feller. Bob Feller never won a World Series game, and it was in a nothing-nothing game with the Boston Braves. And Phil Macy was on second base. He was sort of a catcher running guy. And he had a big lead, and Lou Boudreau, who was this shortstop and Hall of Famer and Feller, did that play. And they picked off Phil Macy, and the umpire blew the call.
Oh, no.
He blew, and there's no replay. I mean,
right.
They had all the pictures in the newspaper the next day, you know. I mean, there was daylight. I mean, that's
right.
How much they got him by. And then maybe Eddie Stanky, I forget who got the hit, but someone got the hit, and Feller lost the game 1-0. So
wow.
I always remember that play.
Wow.
That's a play.
Well, you know, the knowledge you have on this baseball stuff, Marty, it just amazes me. To your point, that's how important these plays can be in a game. And, you know, you don't always think about them. You don't always try to put them on. But if you can do these things, it helps you win ball games.
Yeah, the little things. I'll tell you, yesterday I thought, you know, Mike Morse gets a base hit. Okay, so he walked and he got a hit in that game. Morse was a factor. Then you guys pinch ran for him with Gorky Hernandez, who steals second, and the throw gets away, but he gets to second base. And then he gets a good secondary lead. And you tell the story, because he got to third on a ground ball that was sort of hit behind him. He said, uh-oh, it's to the left side, but is he going to go? And he got there, and Tomlinson beats out the hit.
Right.
With his speed, as you always say, that 25th guy better have some speed and bring something to the table. And it was a huge run for you. So that was a big play yesterday.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and it's great to see Gorky steal that base in a game like that. I mean, you're having a hard time scoring runs. You want to make something happen, right? You want to take advantage of any weakness the other team may have, the pitcher's slow or not, or pick a breaking ball and try to make something happen. So he stole the base. And the ball that he went on is a ball that, you know, Phil Nevin, our third base coach, working with the runners, and every player in the game, they stand out at second base in spring training almost every day, and they're reading balls at second, because those were most of the reads come in. You know, you work at first base, you work at reads at third, but there's so many different plays that occur in a game from second base, you know, the fly ball, do I tag up or do I go halfway? The ground ball, read the ground ball. And just because it's hit to the left side doesn't mean you can't get the third. It depends where the third baseman's playing. Does he vacate and I can get around him? Is it hit? you know, slowly to my left, like that ball was. So that's what you're supposed to do. Those are the reads you're supposed to get as a good base runner.
And he did. He made a very good read on that. I was reading a book about Casey Stengel the other day, and it was very interesting. And of course, he actually played for the New York Giants. He played for the Brooklyn Dodgers. He managed the Dodgers. He was a Yankee manager. He managed the Mets. He's the only guy who played or managed all the four New York teams. But he was a very wealthy man. And in the 30s, he was invited to invest in some oil wells that hadn't hit yet in Texas. And they eventually hit. And then he brought in some of his friends, Al Lopez, the manager of the Indians, and other players. He brought him in, and everyone was making money on the oil wells. So it made me think of you. You ever been invited to invest in any oil wells?
Well, first off, I never made enough money for anybody to ask me to invest in oil wells, but I will tell you this. Billy Hayes has been trying to get my 10 bucks I have invested in the stock market, and he wants me to sell it all and buy gold. So he's okay. Trying to get me to buy gold, and
right.
It's interesting. I watched a movie last night, Gold, with Matthew McConaughey. I just watched that last evening, but no, to answer your question, nobody ever asked me to invest in anything. No.
Well, it's part of, you know, it's, I ask you, you know, half seriously, because it is part of baseball.
Oh, sure.
Because you know, there is money flying around and investments going on and all sorts of stuff, and you see people who make money and don't make money.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the players, especially these guys that make money, I mean, they're approached all the time, and you hear the great stories of these guys investing. You hear the horror stories of investments gone bad with players. I have over the years, but I'm sure the guys in that room over there have been approached many times with different investments, and I'm not sure if anybody's been approached with oil or not.
Yeah, okay. Oil wells.
Oil
wells. All right. When I grew up with Mickey Mantle, had restaurants, he had bowling alleys. Things never worked out. You know, those things never worked out. But, yeah, it's part of the game of baseball. Well, getting back to the 17-inning game before we leave it, Crawford made a heck of a play. And a couple of aspects of it made me think of you. One, the infield was really in. I mean, they were like almost beyond the beyond the cut of the grass. And the ball was hit at him, and he bobbled it and went up to his chest and then grabbed it, never lost sight of what was going on, and made the great play, and Posey made the tag. So two things. One, positioning of the infield. Sometimes you're partway in, all the way in, and then, of course, the play he made.
Right. Well, you know, there's a couple different depths that you can use. You know, it depends on the outs and the runner's speed at third. You know, you really don't want to play all the way into the cut of the grass unless you absolutely have to. And the scenario where you have to is where that run is a huge run. It's going to win the game. It's going to put them ahead, you know, in the seventh, eighth inning. And the runner at third is fast because you have to protect. If the ball's hit very slowly, you can still get them at the plate. There's other points in the game. There could be one out, and instead of playing all the way in on the grass, the runner at third is not very fast. He's an average runner. He's slower. You want to get as much depth as you can and still be able to make the play. And, you know, maybe it's the third inning where you're playing in to cut off the run, but you don't feel like that run might be the one that beats you. You don't want to give him the run, but you might play a little bit deeper and expect a firm hit ball where you can throw him out. So the speed of the runner, how important the run is during a game, and then the outs are very important. So, you know, I know you got a lot of listeners out there that, you know, that play the game and coach the game. And with nobody out, it's a different scenario. When we have nobody out and you want to cut off that run, you really shouldn't play the infield all the way in, because the third base coach in the offensive team, if you just play kind of halfway and that guy can't run, they're probably not going to send the runner with nobody out because they figure, okay, it's one out. We still got another shot to score him with another batter. So you don't have to play all the way in on the grass there. You could play more of a halfway position, just in enough to where that third base coach and that runner are going to say, we're not going to try to score because, you know, we got another hitter coming up that can get us in without a hit.
Got it. So the number of outs, well, this one, the game was on the line.
Game was on the line. a line you have to be in.
Yeah, you couldn't go partway. I mean, you had to take the gamble that the ball would be hit right at somebody.
Right, and you know that's why. I mean, you gain a little more range when you're deeper, but you can't take the chance. Yeah. Say the guy jams, you know, gets a jam shot, and you're trying to get three or four steps back, and you end up losing the game. It doesn't make any sense. So if the run's that important, and you're playing in. Go up on the cut of the grass. It's a bang-bang play. That runner at third gets a good jump.
Yeah.
It's going to be a bang-bang play, which it was for Crawley. He had that little bobble. He had that little bobble in there. A ball was smoked right at him. But that's what makes him such a good player. There was no panic. He caught the ball on the bobble, and then he fired a strike to home.
Yeah, very good. It was good baseball. That's a good. That's the professor talking. All right, because they were on the grass. I'm telling you, he was as far in as I've ever seen the infield go in. To make sure that play was made.
Yeah, we couldn't let them score that run.
I'll tell you another one. We're going to take a break in a second here, and I talked about it yesterday. Billy Hamilton, who has just been, you know, what can I tell you? You know, you've seen it. You know, he changes the game around. But he came up in a very critical situation with Corey Guerin on the mound, and Guerin was all over the place, and the ball was moving. He hit somebody, and he went 3-1 on Billy Hamilton with the bases loaded. And Billy Hamilton helped him. I mean, there was a pitch, it probably was ball four, and he swung at the 3-1 pitch.
Right.
So it made me think. I said to myself, do they ever give this take sign anymore? Does anyone ever say, look, even though you're a major league player, you know what you're doing, and but don't swing, will you? Will you take a pitch? Does that ever happen anymore?
Well, it does, and it really depends on the hitter. And most of the time in the big leagues, a 3-1 count with the game on the line, you're on the road. You know, if you take, you're scoring one run. I mean, he's been swinging the bat hot.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
He's been getting a lot of hits. If he hits a ball in the gap or gets a hit, you get two, maybe three runs.
Okay.
And, you know, we still have to hit. So it's not like you're at home where it's the win right then and there.
Okay.
But I still think you would have some managers that would give the take and put the pressure on the pitcher because, you know, Billy probably can hit the same pitch 3-2 that he would swinging at the 3-1 pitch. So I think some people were surprised he didn't have the take, but, you know, you like to have the hitter be able to not swing at a borderline pitch. And a lot of players would take on their own. They say, hey, I'm going to make them throw me a strike 3-2 because it's such an important pitch.
All right, but I understand the other part of it is you're on the road and you may want to bust the game open at that point. Okay, I hadn't thought it through that way. But, yeah, I said, wow, interesting. Someone called in yesterday. I'm going to ask one more question here before we take our break. 3-0 count. And someone was saying, why don't they swing more in 3-0? 3-0, that pitch comes right down the middle. Does everyone have the green light on 3-0 on the Giants? Do you guys stop people or how do you do it?
Yeah, no, not everybody does. There's a sign. There's a sign that, you know, a Boach will give and it gets relayed. Not everybody swings 3-0. Certain guys do. And, you know, some guys don't want to swing 3-0. There's been a lot of players over the course of the year. You want them to hit because you want them to hit the ball in the gap or hit a double opposed to a walk or maybe even a homer. And the guys don't want to swing 3-0. They're not comfortable doing it. Then there's other guys that love swinging 3-0. So, but there is a sign. The manager controls, you know, who he wants to let swing in that scenario, or not swing.
So you guys do that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, some guys swing 3-0 and some guys don't. It's just not the hitter. It could be the situation of the game.
Of
and yeah, a lot has to do with it, right? Who's hitting behind them? Who's coming up? Who's the pitcher? So there's a lot of things that are involved, but most of the time, your better hitters, guys that can drive the ball out of the ballpark or hit the ball, you know, in the gap, are going to get an opportunity once in a while to swing 3-0.
All right, very good. All right, let's take a breath. The professor, boy, you're pretty good this morning. You're teaching a lot of baseball this morning. Very
covering
good.
A lot of ground today.
Yeah,
Martin.
Really. All right, we'll take a break. We'll do another segment here, just a very brief one with Ron Wotus when we come back. And we've got baseball coming up today as Jeff Samardzija goes to the hill today. He's pitched really well, not walking people, striking everybody out. He's at home today. And, well, you got Tim Adelman on the other side, a younger 29-year-old from Georgetown. You know, this is the cerebral guy, a right-hander, and he's kicked around a little bit. But he gives up some home runs in his background, so maybe there's some home runs today. It looks like a windy, nice day.
I'm sure it's going to be gorgeous out there. I haven't seen him pitch. I know he's got a fastball, curveball, change. He's supposed to have a pretty good changeup and handles the lefties well because of that changeup. So We'll take a look at them here shortly, but yeah, you know what? Hopefully Shark will be throwing the ball the way he has been. He's pitched very well for us, especially as of late.
Four walks, 39 strikeouts for him. That's his last five games. How about that for Samardzija?
For Samardzija, that's outstanding. He's throwing that back foot slider. He's really pitching. You know, he's really using both sides of the plate and liked what he's been doing.
Just since you brought it up, Adelman, 9 for 43, lefties against him, 9 for 43, righties, 16 for 57.
Yeah.
So a little bit better. Four of the homers, lefties, three righties.
Yeah. Well,
seven homers in 26 innings, so, you know.
Yeah, and we've been hitting a few. It'd be nice to get a couple more today.
Yeah, get loose out there. There was an article in the paper today, and it was interesting. I call it the paper. On the internet, there is no paper.
That's right.
But it was very interesting, and it said this, on retired numbers. Now, of course, you look up on the board, and there's, you know, Mays and McCovey and Cepeda and Marichaux and all the great numbers. But you look at a guy, say, like Will Clark, and they brought up Bo Jackson and different players for different franchises. And they said, well, for those players, they're not going to retire the number. They're not Hall of Famers. But they should be honored, and they should be still connected to the everyday game. And they suggested that those numbers perhaps be worn by a manager or a coach. So those numbers are still connected to the game of baseball. And I was thinking of you, or Bruce Bochy. I said, well, what if they gave you number 55 and you became Lincecum? You know what I mean? And I don't know. Of course, you have your number, and your number is 23 now. And as a coach, you probably get different numbers depending on players
right.
who come in.
Right.
But what do you think about that idea? Kind of, you know, keeping the memory of those players alive through the coaches or the manager.
Yeah. I think it's great to keep the memory of those players alive. You know, I'm not quite sure how that would go over with the coaches and the managers. I mean, just a simple fact that, you know, how do you decide, you know, you only have six coaches or one manager. How do you decide what number do you want him to wear? I guess it wouldn't be that big of a deal.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think about us as coaches, and, you know, if they tried to give me Will Clark's number, I'd probably get picked on quite a bit and say, well, you can't wear Will Clark's number. You couldn't play like Will Clark. So, yeah, I don't know. I think that's one for the fans and the talk shows to kick around and see what they have to say.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah.
I like it. I think, why not? I always felt Will Clark should have something in the ballpark anyway. You know,
sure,
I know how he comes around, and he's amazing.
I agree with that. Look, you know, we have such a great tradition here, and you know, we're very fortunate to have Will Clark here at the park helping us out, and you know, the great Giant players. I mean, that's, you know, the fans have those memories. That's the tradition of the Giants, and they should be honored in some way, no question.
Yeah, I think so. I like it. Okay, yeah. I could see you let the hair grow again. And you're 55.
Go back to Lincecum.
That's
okay.
Right.
I see the analogy.
Okay. I still have that picture of you as a teenager with the hair at your shoulders there. All right. Derek Jeter's number is going to be retired. The only number that will be left, single-digit number, that has not been retired for the Yankees is zero.
No kidding.
Yeah. This is number two as retired for Jeter, and I think that's Frankie Crosetti's number as well. But your thoughts about Jeter? You know, obviously, I think you've probably had some games against him.
Yeah, you know, obviously I coached when he was a player, and, you know, with all the Yankees that we have here, I've heard many stories about him, never played alongside him, but one or a couple come from Joe LaFay, our hitting coach, who was worked with me in the minor leagues. We coached together, and, you know, he had Jeter all the way up. He had all those great Yankees that came through, and he really admired Jeter, and I've watched him over the years from afar, and I have tremendous respect for Derek Jeter. I think he's a consummate professional. You know, I identify with him. He approaches the game the right way. You know, he doesn't run his mouth. All the things that you'd want your kids to identify with and play the game. And he did it. And, you know, he worked extremely hard to make himself a great player. I'll share this with you, but Joe LaFay told me, you know, 1 year Derek Jeter in the minor leagues made 60 errors at shortstop.
That's right.
60 errors. And they sent him to the instructional league the following year. And, you know, they didn't let him hit. He went to the instructional league, and all he did was play defense to improve his defense.
Wow.
That's what they wanted him to do. And I thought that was great. So, Derek Jeter, a class act, a winning player, always came up big in the big moments, and great admiration for Derek Jeter.
Yeah, good story. Mike Gallego, who's the coach with the A's, was the shortstop who preceded Derek Jeter.
Yeah,
and they said to Gallego, move over a little bit. We want to let this guy play a little,
Right. Right. Well, there's another guy on our team that tried to precede Derek Jeter. Is Eduardo Nunez.
Okay.
Eddie Nunez came up when Derek Jeter was there. Now, they moved him to third base, and they gave him some left field and all that. But when Derek was at the end, you know, he was trying to break in with the Yankees. And, you know, last year, he made a play on the field, and somebody said, great play. And Eddie jokingly said, oh, it's not a great play. Derek Jeter used to tell me you're supposed to make that play.
Very good.
It's a routine play.
That's Frank Robinson, you know. You have a good day, I'm supposed to have a good day.
Exactly.
I always love that saying from him. One last thought on the Yankee situation. Jorge Posada was interviewed, and he said Yogi Berra gave him a great tip. And Posada said, Yogi, how did you know what the guy was going to throw and what the pitcher had, you know, the opposing pitcher? Yogi said, well, why don't you watch what the guy works on between innings when he comes out? If he's throwing a lot of fastballs, he's probably thinking fastball. If he's throwing curveballs, changeups, he's probably thinking, I've got to get those pitches down. And that's what I'm going to try to throw. Does that make sense?
Well, I can't deny what Yogi Berra said, can I?
He hit
a heck of a lot better than I ever did. You know what? I think that the most important takeaway from that is you need to watch the game. You need to watch the pitcher warm up. You know, in today's game, we look at, you know, the statistics or the video or his heat map or, you know, percentages of what he's throwing. But a lot of the great hitters, I remember George Brett in spring training. I played with the Royals. He never missed a pitch during a game. He never wanted to miss a pitch. You know, you have to watch the guy warm up because you do pick up things. You see what's he throwing over the plate and what he is not throwing over the plate. I don't know if it's as much what he's throwing between innings to try to work on, but it's more the command of the pitches and what he can command. Now you can eliminate pitches, and now hitting becomes easier. Instead of worrying about four pitches, if you only know he can throw two for strikes, that's all you're looking for.
I got to ask a pitcher. I got to ask Dave Rigetti one of the catchers who warms people up. What do you throw, and why do you throw it? I thought it was a good point. It was a good thinking point.
It would be
for
a good question for them. Yeah,
I thought it was a good thinking point for me. Hey, Ted Williams used to say, I would sit on. Now, the pitchers used to warm up in front of the dugout. The starting pitcher would warm up in front of the dugout.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and not the bullpen. You know, there was a little area right in front of the dugout. They had a mound, not a mound, but the home plate, and the guy would warm up sort of on flat ground, I think.
That's amazing because I always wondered, you know, how the pitcher felt when, you know, a pitcher gets injured and they have to come in from the bullpen and now they have to warm up on the game mound, you know, and sit there for 10 minutes and throw all their pitches and let the other hitters watch them warm up the whole time. That'd be a great question for the pitchers as well. I know they want to maybe get on the game mound, but I always felt like keep them in the bullpen until they're ready to come and then let them come on the game mound, throw his seven pitches and start the inning as opposed to staying out there.
Okay, well, Williams sat there and said, I watched the guy warm up. Watched and then I figured out, you know, what he was going to do.
No question.
And look, in the old days, they would trick you. You know, they'd say they'd have three people warm up or they'd have a guy warm up under the stands.
Right.
And then they'd bring him out. The famous 1929 World Series, Howard Emke set the World Series strikeout record for the Philadelphia Athletics against the Cubs. He was like 35 years old. They had him warm up under the stands. The Cubs were shocked that he was going to pitch, and he set the strikeout record that lasted till Carl Erskine in the 50s.
Right. No, the game has changed quite a bit in that regard. And but back to your point about, you know, guys throwing underneath or in the bullpen, you know, watching the guy throw is very important to a hitter. You know, it's not what he did. We just read the stats of Adelman. It's not what he did last week or his last start. It's what's he going to do today? And when he gets on that mound, if he can't throw his breaking ball over the plate, you know, why are you going to look for it? And you think about my generation when I played, we'd come out early, sit on the bench. You know, you'd watch infield, one, to see the arm strength of the outfielders, but two, you'd watch the pitcher warm up in the bullpen to see what his command was. And then when he threw his seven pitches, you'd look at that, and you'd have an advantage in the moment, not looking at statistics and papers and heat maps and things like that.
Well, that's what Yogi was talking about.
Yeah,
really.
Exactly.
Well, let's see. Can I do your job the rest of the day? You want to do the rest of the show?
No, thank you.
I'll send you out to Pat.
No, thank you. I don't think I can handle this part. Thank you, Marty.
You did great. Very good, Will. Thank you.
Enjoyed it. Good seeing you again.
Very good. All right. That's the Professor Ron Wotus. More coming up on the Sports Leader.